I want to bring out our next speaker. He's going to talk. Then we're going to immediately go to question and answer. Everywhere I go with Scott Ritter, every day we go somewhere, I learn about five new things. If there's an expert about Iran and Iraq, about U.S. intelligence and its failures, or the failures to use U.S. intelligence, it's Scott Ritter. And because he's such an expert, he seems to get very little play on mainstream media. His books are great. There's still some he can sign for you before we rush out. He's got books, Iraq Confidential, a crucial book, a historic book that tells you it's important for people to pick that book up to see someone who's right. The books over here we have by Scott are Target Iran and Waging Peace. He's a former Marine, former military intelligence officer, former UN weapons inspector, always fought for the truth. The great journalist, perhaps our best American journalist, Seymour Hersh, said this about Scott Ritter. The most important thing you need to know about Scott Ritter is that he got it right. Scott Ritter.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for that. You know, I've been traveling with Jeff for the last couple weeks, and every time he tells that Glenn Beck story, my ire just rises. And, you know, Beck's producers have been calling me and saying, hey, you got to come on the show. And I've been turning them down because I don't want to engage in that kind of fist fight on air. But after listening to this, you know, I'm going to say yes and then offer my neck to Glenn and then teach him a thing or two about Marine Corps close quarter combat. I know we're supposed to be pacifists and peace-loving people, but there are some things worth fighting for, and that's that's one of them. It's an honor and a privilege to be here Columbus, Ohio. I say Dayton because the only time I've been in this neck of the woods is actually up the road with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base back in the day when I was an intelligence officer and would travel back and forth doing things about Soviet ballistic missiles that we're not allowed to talk about. But it's also interesting to be in a union hall. I may be the only person that labels themselves a Reagan Republican in this room. You can save your hisses for later. But it's the other interesting thing about this long, strange journey that I've been embarked on with Jeff and others is the education that I've received from political elements I may not have otherwise associated with in my past. I was a national defense guy. I was somebody who did intelligence business. I wasn't a domestic policy person, and I embraced certain belief systems and ideals and values because I was solely focused on the issue of national security and preserving America's strength. Since speaking out about Iraq, what I found is that one of the most inclusive elements of American society is the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. It's amazing how open-minded they are to bring in somebody who doesn't look like them, doesn't talk like them, doesn't walk like them. But we all acknowledge at the end of the day, and this is the most important thing, that if you define yourself as a Democrat, you define yourself as a Republican, you define yourself as anything other than an American, you're doing your nation a disservice. It's America first and your political affiliation second. I know we have in the audience today a lot of people who are part of the Ron Paul Revolution. And I don't have to explain to them the importance of the Constitution of the United States of America. I shouldn't have to explain to anybody in this audience the importance of the Constitution of the United States of America because it is the only thing that defines America. There's nothing else. You can sit here and talk about, you know, Hillary Clinton's platform and John McCain's platform, but unless their platform goes back down to a foundational element of belief that links us all, it's not an American platform. And there is only one thing that does that, and it's the Constitution. Now, I know I'm in a hall of activists, but answer this question honestly. It's one I ask everywhere I go, and I would like an honest answer. How many people here have actually read the Constitution cover to cover? Now, keep your hands up, because now we have part two of the very important question. If I were going to give you a test right now where 80% is considered mastery of the subject, how many of you can guarantee you're going to pass that test on the Constitution? It's not a dishonor, guys. You're doing the same as everybody else in the country. How can you call yourself an American if you are not intimately familiar with that which defines what an American is? How can you defend America if you are not intimately familiar with the document that says this is who we are? And people say, why are we in trouble today? And I will tell you, it comes down to this basic core problem, because we don't know who we are. We say we're Americans. We pretend to act like Americans, but our actions are not linked to the document that sets down the ideals and values that truly are American. And that is something we need to fix. As we speak, to put this in a proper perspective, there are 160,000 brave American men and women who honor us by wearing the uniform of the Armed Services of the United States of America, our uniform, not the president's uniform, not Congress's uniform, our uniform. You see, they took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That document that they swore an oath to doesn't begin, I, the President of the United States of America, or we, the Congress of the United States of America. It begins, we, the people of the United States of America. It is our document. These are our troops, and we owe it to them to do right by them. Somewhere right now in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's a child waking up, putting on their uniform, lacing up their boots, and given this day of modern communication, they've probably sent an email home, maybe made a phone call or a text message to their loved one saying, I'm okay. Everything's cool. It's Sunday, there's a mom, pa sitting around the table going, just talk to Susie, just talk to Chucky, and they're doing all right. I'm feeling pretty good. I'm drinking my cup of coffee. I'm reading the newspaper, watching TV, relaxing. Statistically speaking, there's a good chance that one or two of these kids are going to die today. There's a good chance that a half a dozen of them are going to be wounded. And within 24 hours, it's going to be the knock at the door. Somebody in uniform with the message nobody wants to hear. I regret to inform you that fill-in-the-blank has died in the service of his or her country. This is what we're talking about here. It's not a game. It's reality. These kids are out there prepared to make a sacrifice. Is it not incumbent upon us to ensure that before we ask them to make this sacrifice, that we make absolutely certain it is in a cause worthy of the sacrifice? And ladies and gentlemen, nothing about Iraq is worth the sacrifice of a single American life, let alone nearly 4,000. Now, I've heard this over and over again from people. Don't blame us. It's the media's fault. And Jeff makes a compelling case that, indeed, the media plays an important role in shaping the perceptions, and perceptions are reality, of the American public. But I don't cut the people of America any slack whatsoever, because at the end of the day, it's our country, it's our government, and therefore it's our fault. When I hear people say, the media, blame the media, it just reminds me of springtime in New York. Now, you might think that's a little weird, but you live here in Columbus, Ohio, similar weather patterns. It's cold right now, is it not? You got snow on the ground. Spring's going to come. And when it does, the sun's going to rise, and the trees are going to bloom. Grass is going to go green, and the birds are going to come flying back from the south where they've been migrating. It's amazing what happens. These birds are pretty productive little creatures. They go around, they pick up twigs, and they make nests in trees. Then they lay eggs, the miracle of life. And the eggs hatch, and little birds pop out. And they go, tweet, 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 tweet. And mama bird's up in the tree, and she goes, oh, my babies, they're hungry. And she flies out, and she gathers worms and bugs, and she eats them. And then she flies to the nest and she pukes down their little throats. And the little birds go, thank you for feeding me. Thank you for feeding me. It reminds me of the American public every time they turn on the TV and look at mainstream news. Tweet, tweet, tweet. And the news pukes right down their throat and gives them exactly what they asked for. Let's stop being little birds, ladies and gentlemen, and start becoming hunter raptors. You know, we've been given a gift. The most powerful supercomputer in the world, the one that resides between this earlobe and this earlobe. It's capable of a remarkable thing called independent thought. You don't have to sit there and go, I must learn by turning on the television. No, I was an intelligence officer. Let me give you a short course on how you can become an intelligence officer. Your own civilian intelligence corps. It's very simple, five easy steps. Step number one, direction. That's an important step. You see, let me ask you this. You open up the Columbus Dispatch. I did learn something about this, hopefully, Larry. And you open it up and you're looking for the news. Were you on the editorial board last night? Did you make a determination what was going to be on the front page? Did you say, hey, I got some concerns about X, so let's make that the leading story? And unless you work for the paper, the answer is no. And yet, by turning to that paper, it's not giving you intelligence. It's giving you what they think you need to know, not what you think you need to know. You didn't ask the question. The same thing when you turn on the TV. You didn't ask the question. Some producer made a decision about what's going to be presented to you. Intelligence requires step one, direction. You must ask the question, what do I need to know? Don't let anybody else ask that question for you. You must ask that question, what do I need to know? Step number one. Step number two, collection. Collect the data. There is no single source of information out there that's going to give you everything you need to know. And yet the American public, as lazy as they are, keeps saying, blame the media because they don't have the magic newspaper that gives truth everywhere. There's no such thing as the magic newspaper that's going to give you truth. Even the British, who have a wonderful reputation for open journalism, when I go to London, I don't get one magic newspaper. I get five when I eat breakfast. And I know when I open up The Guardian, I'm not getting the truth. I'm getting bias in favor of the Labour Party. When I open up the Times, I'm not getting the truth. I'm getting bias in favor of the Conservative Party, the Tories, the Independent Social Democrats. Every newspaper has a bias, and they wear it on their sleeves. They don't hide it. I just put on my bias filter as I read the news, and then I do things. I read the same news story in five different papers. Then I compare and contrast. Why is Labour building this one up and putting this one down? Why are the Times elevating this? And I start looking at it. You know what happens? From the five comes one independent point of view based upon my own perceptions. I am now a thinking individual. Very dangerous in a democracy, a constituent who actually has an independent point of view. Collection. Next step, processing. You got to organize it. You got to make sense of it. You got to get it chronologically. You got to get it by topic, whatever. Organize your data. Next step. The assessment part, actually reading it, sitting there, churning it around your head. Do I have intelligence now? I've assessed it. Do I have intelligence? No. I have to do the last step. Answer the question. And once I answer the question, I have actually produced intelligence. I asked the question, went through a process, and I've answered the question. That's intelligence, ladies and gentlemen. Simple process. But none of us are doing it. Instead, we turn to the television and say, give me that which I need to know. Or we turn to the newspaper and say, please, give me that which I need to know. No. They're going to give you bits and pieces. But unless you ask the question, you collect the data, you process the data, you assess the data, and you answer the question, you're always going to be susceptible to being misled by the media. And ladies and gentlemen, we're being misled as we speak. Just the other day, we were in California. Open up a hotel room, and there it is. USA Today. Wonderful paper, answers all my questions. I sit on the editorial board every night and demand front page coverage and answers my questions. Not really. Newspaper blares out. United States says Baghdad is 75% secure. But holy cow, war's over. War's over. We're winning. We've turned the corner on this one. The surge is a success. USA Today says so. It says so. And it's repeated over and over again. You'll see that mantra everywhere you turn, in the newspaper, on the TV, how the surge is a success. It's so successful, in fact, that while we have 160,000 soldiers deployed overseas in Iraq, not a single politician is talking about them. That's how successful it is. That's how successful it is, ladies and gentlemen. That's not what's happening. The surge is a failure. The surge is a joke, a tragic joke. What you're being told is not the truth. I liken Iraq to a body that's been shot. I'll call it a sucking chest wound. Any combat veterans in here know what I'm talking about. You've been hit in the chest, your lung is deflated, and your body's bleeding out. And that's the reality of Iraq post-Saddam, post-U.S. invasion, post-U.S. occupation. The surge hasn't revived this, reinflated the lung, stopped the bleeding. All the surge has done is place a cosmetic bandage over the wound. So we don't see the blood. And we say, aha, it's all fixed. The evidence cited for the success of the surge is the drop in casualties amongst the American military. 2007, the year that we say the surge succeeded, was the bloodiest year in Iraq yet for the U.S. military. I will make the following prediction. 2008 will be even worse, because eventually the bandage will fall off. You're going to be dealing with a body that is as close to being a corpse as possible. Iraq, as we knew it, is gone. America has destroyed this nation. We talk about a government, a functioning government in Baghdad. There is no functioning government in Baghdad. The Purple Finger Revolution of January 2005 was as much a farce as anything you've ever seen in your life. It was not a free and democratic election. It was a setup. And the end result is you have a government that is totally out of whack with the rest of the country. And as Jeff said, the only reason why Baghdad has seen a drop in violence is that we've already ethnically cleansed it. What happens when the people of Baghdad decide that they're not happy with the status quo ante? Because I'll tell you this, the situation in Baghdad is not sustainable. It is not sustainable. It's unnatural. It will fall apart, and there will be violence. What happens when the awakening in Western Iraq, the Sunni tribes that we've now funded, trained, and equipped into their own standalone militias, realize that they're not going to be invited back into the government of Iraq? Will they willfully give up these weapons? Or will they attack the government of Iraq, and when we stand up for the government of Iraq, they'll attack us again, but this time better armed, better equipped, better trained? What happens when the Shia of Muqtada al-Sadr, who declared a unilateral ceasefire, and in the intervening time, armed, trained, and equipped, decide, you're not going to let us into the government, and we're going to oppose the government, and the Americans support this fake government, and they start fighting us, but this time better armed, better trained, better equipped? What about that bastion of stability in northern Iraq, Kurdistan? What happens when that farce falls apart as it is right now? When we realize there's no such thing as a singular Kurdish people in Iraq, but a whole bunch of competing factions. What happens when the KDP and the PUK start fighting over who has better control of the PKK or the PJAK? And the alphabet soup goes on. It's a disaster that just isn't being recognized as such, ladies and gentlemen. The surge has failed. We're just not talking about it. The other thing we're not talking about is the next looming disaster, Iran. As we speak, the President and the United States Congress are facilitating the buildup of American power in the Middle East that will give us the ability to initiate a 7-day limited aerial campaign against Iran, starting sometime in March, April. I'm not saying that it's 100% we're going to do it. I'm just saying that come March and April, we'll have all the pieces in place to start this campaign. And it's a campaign that's predicated on anticipating the failure of this 7-day limited aerial campaign, so they will go to a 30-day extended surge of airstrikes. This is the thinking in this administration. Now, where is the debate in Congress? There is none. Where is the discussion amongst the presidential candidates? There is none. Where is the discussion in the mainstream media? There is none, except to parrot in a similar fashion as our good friend, the CIA nut. No, Pollack. Ken Pollack, my best friend. CIA. Let me tell you about him someday. It gives the CIA a bad name in more ways than one. But I say it because, I'm an intelligence officer, and I have a lot of regard for the potential of the CIA to do good things in legitimate national security of the United States of America. And there's a lot of men and women who honor us by serving in the CIA, who risk their lives to do amazing things for this country that we will never know about. And have their Valerie Plame and others like that, who have their reputations smeared by scum like this Ken Pollack. And that's why I take it so personally, because he has truly destroyed the reputation of an honorable service. Now, trust me, the CIA does bad things too. I'm not here to give them a clean bill of health. But, the media is simply parroting the claims made by the Bush administration that Iran constitutes a threat worthy of military intervention. And how does the Bush administration define this threat? Twofold: a nation pursuing nuclear weapons and the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today. Now, the Bush administration says all options are on the table to resolve the problem of Iran. The Bush administration also said that it will solve the problem of Iran before they leave office. Now, if they were defining Iran in terms of a nation that could be approached diplomatically, I might have confidence that one of these options being considered would be the diplomatic option. But when you define the problem consistently as a nail, the only solution, therefore, becomes the hammer. And that's really the only option that's on the table. It's the only option that can handle a problem such as a nation illegally pursuing nuclear weapons who at the same time is the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today. And that, of course, is what we're being told over and over and over again. Now, some of you might say, well, excuse me, Scott, didn't they just publish a national intelligence estimate that said that there is no active program in Iran today for nuclear weapons? And they did. Correct. Came out in November. Wonderful document. Everybody rushed to embrace it. The left was so relieved because they said, hallelujah, there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran. We are saved. Read the damn document. I reject it wholeheartedly as a fabrication and falsehood and misrepresentation of fact along the lines of that of the CIA's estimate about Iraqi WMD in October of 2002, the one that got us into a war in Iraq. Why do I reject it? Because to accept the premise that Iran doesn't have an ongoing active nuclear weapons program today, or accept the conclusion, you have to embrace the premise, which is they had one in 2003 that they have stopped. And so in the rush for everybody endorsing the conclusion, they've legitimized the premise, which is a false premise. Iran has never had a nuclear weapons program at any time. But the problem is the president of the United States has now jumped on this. He has said that they may not be pursuing it today, but we know. We know that they had one in 2003. That's no longer being debated because everybody embraced the NIE. They had one in 2003. It was kept in secrecy. It has not been declared. It has not been inspected. Therefore, we must assume that it's still in place. And until which time, and here's the trap, ladies and gentlemen, until which time Iran declares this program in its totality and opens up their country to full inspection to verify the existence of this program and confirm it's no longer in place, we will assume it continues to exist. This is a false trap along the lines of the one they set for the Iraqis in November of 2002 when the Security Council said you must submit a declaration listing the full, final, and complete accounting of your WMD, and Iraq did so, preparing a 15,000-page document. But before that document came to the UN, Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, said that unless this document admits an ongoing biological weapons program in Iraq and provides an annex that details where these weapons are hidden, we will reject this document in its totality as fraudulent. The Iraqis submit the document. Of course, there is no admission of an ongoing biological weapons program because there is no ongoing biological weapons program, and there can be no annex listing where the weapons are stored because there are no weapons. But the U.S. rejected this document and went to war against Iraq. The president has set the same false conditions today, that Iran must declare a nuclear weapons program it never had. It must open itself up for inspections of sites that never existed. And he's doing this in a manner which is readily embraced by mainstream media, who are all at the same time ignoring the reality that while the president was in Israel planning military action against Iran and in the Gulf Arab states trying to drum up support for this military action, another airplane was landing in Tehran, this one carrying a passenger named Mohammed El-Baradei, the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the organization mandated since 2002 to carry out intrusive inspections in Iran covering the totality of Iran's declared nuclear infrastructure. Mohammed El-Baradei has concluded, based upon the technical work of his inspectors on the ground in Iran, that there is no evidence to support or sustain the assertion that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Mohammed El-Baradei was in Iran to meet with their president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, to meet with the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei. Or Khamenei. Khamenei was the president. You know, I'm a Marine guy. So these names. Khamenei. The point is, when the president says all options are on the table, he's only pursuing one option based upon a false premise. There's actually another person who's pursuing genuine diplomacy based upon fact. And the end result is that the Iranians and the IAEA say that we are very close to coming to closure on these outstanding issues. Closure, meaning there is nothing to worry about. But that's not being reported. We're told that Iran is an ugly threat. This nuclear weapons program that never existed has had life breathed into it again by falsehood after falsehood after falsehood. Be your own intelligence officer, ladies and gentlemen. Be the informed citizen you need to be. Because if you do not head down the path of declaring independence from corporate-controlled media, if you do not go down the path of asserting your duties and responsibilities as citizens, we will be at war in Iran that will make the conflict in Iraq pale by comparison. These are dangerous times. I'm not standing up here as a harbinger of doom. I'm not giving you a guarantee that there will be conflict in Iran because, you know, this is not a war of necessity. Iran does not pose a threat to the United States of America worthy of military intervention. This is an elective war based upon the political ideology of a handful of people who see global domination as opposed to multilateral cooperation. And they succeed because we remain silent. It's the way it has worked throughout history, where the silence and compliance of the masses liberate a few to carry out a message which is not in keeping with stated ideals and values. People say, well, I'm being a little harsh on the American public sometimes, that it's I shouldn't blame them. It's really not their fault. They didn't mean to be controlled to this extent. I just don't accept this. There is a responsibility of citizenship. And if you're going to call yourself an American, you better be prepared to act as an American in defense of things that are worth fighting for. And there's nothing worth fighting for more than the Constitution, the principles, the values, and ideals that define this great nation. The battlefield is here at home, not abroad. We have to focus on certain realities, though, ladies and gentlemen. While we're critical of foreign policy, I'm going to leave you with a very uncomfortable thought. The day America heads down the path of global empire is the day that I stop supporting America because it stopped being America. All empires end, and most end badly. That's not the future I want. Let's work together to make a better future for America. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.